Tereo Ererangi o Te Mānia. This episode was produced in Otatahi by Plains Media, with support from New Zealand On Air.
It's time for Bookends, sponsored by Scorpio Books.
Kia ora, welcome to Bookends. This is our last program of the year. Marianne Stone and Morin Rout.
Meri kirihimite, Bookends listeners. It's a conservation theme, I think, Morin.
Pretty well, yeah. I don't know if I'm starting off, but my author is Richard Wolfe, who, together with Andrew Mackay, has written a book about Thomas Cheesman, who was the first director of the Auckland Museums. So it follows, he was there for 50 years and it follows his life and work. And he was not just a curator, but a keen and extremely good botanist.
Amazing. I'm speaking with Robin and Sandy Toy about the book Caring for Kahurangi, Extraordinary, Beautiful, Inspiring. And then Kat Quinn with her beautiful story about Kuwi the Kiwi. Kia ora anō, Bookends listeners. This next pukapuka is the last children's book we will be discussing this year on Bookends, and it is an anthology, Tino Atahua, a collection of stories about Kuwi the Kiwi, from author and illustrator Kat Quinn. The opening story, Kuwi's First Egg, is a children's book that makes a young mother's experience relatable while making the child being read to feel all the glow of adoring attention Kuwi shines on her precious egg. The stories about Kuwi, baby Kuwi, and all their friends can be enjoyed separately, but they make a beautiful collection. Thanks for joining us, Kat. Tēnā koe. And
kia ora.
Thank you very much for all the lovely books to share with Tamariki over the years.
Oh, it's such a pleasure.
It's quite something to have produced enough work to require an anthology, Kat. That's quite an achievement. The book won the Storylines, Kuwi's First Egg, that first story, won the 2025 Storylines Gaylene Gordon Award for a work that stood the test of time. That's quite an endorsement to get in the year that you release an anthology, isn't it? How does it feel to have that award?
It was just amazing. So really, really special, especially when I had first released Kuwi's First Egg. I did it kind of just for my whānau and for my children, and without thinking that it would be something that would be super popular, and also not thinking that it would be popular for more than 10 years. So I do feel really lucky. And the award was extra special because it was presented to me by Tessa Duda, who's amazing author that I look up to. And also the award, Gaylene was a teacher at the school that I went to before my time, but it's still quite a nice little connection. So Hamilton Girls High, she was an English teacher there.
Right. That's a lovely connection. And yeah, being presented anything by Tessa Duda would be quite a thrill for all of us who grew up loving her books. Your distinctive illustrative style, because you author and illustrate, which is, important to acknowledge here, and you've got a really distinctive illustrative style. It's very colourful. There's large expressive eyes and lots of tiny fun details. You mention Richard's scary books as an early childhood inspiration, I think, in the notes that I've read. What other influences do you credit for your style of illustration?
Definitely my parents. So my parents are really into literature. They our special family things, our trips from the farm, and we lived in a rural part of Waikato. Were trips to their public library. So every Friday night, Mum and Dad would take us to the public library. My older sisters really loved big novels and were very well-read, whereas I really gravitated towards the huge illustrated, lots of pictures, little amount of words when I was small. So Richard Scarry, Morris Sendak, yeah, lots of those 80s amazing. You know, there was, like, even Where's Wally, I really liked things that I could dive into the illustrations and find all the little hidden Easter eggs.
Right, yeah. Fantastic. And that going to town on a Friday, part of New Zealand growing up, rural life. I grew up in the 70s in a small town in North Canterbury, but yeah, going to town on Friday night, that was the thing, and going to the library as part of that. That's a lovely anecdote. Tell me about your connection with Aotearoa's wildlife and a kind of like how you came to Kui as your main character.
Yeah, so before I was born, my dad worked for the Wildlife Service, it was called back then, but the Department of Conservation. And he did a lot of work with Takahe, and they were one of the groups that had found a kakapo feather back in the day. And so he was really, as we were growing up, he was telling us stories about native birds and also teaching us about how we should protect them and how important they are to our country, like how special that we've got these amazing creatures. So, yeah, it was kind of Dad filled us with stories of the environment and of native creatures and that kind of thing. So that was just something that I always gravitated towards as I grew up. When I think about stories, we've got such special mysterious, magical creatures that are real, that are here. So it was always what I was going to write about.
So that kakapo feather, before that, the kakapo were considered extinct, weren't they? And was that, am I right there, that it was the discovery of the feather that led to the reclassification?
Yeah, and I wouldn't do it justice to tell you the facts of it, because the way that the Wildlife Service men work is that some of the stories are big and amazing. So I don't know factually exactly what it is, but I just know that, there was a group of them that had discovered a feather after they thought that it had been extinct. And same with Takahe. There was quite a lot of work done with Takahe when they thought that they were also either extinct or on the brink of extinction.
Hey, here's a fact that you could throw into a future book, Kat, about Takahe. They can poop 9 metres in a day. That's something from the person that I'm interviewing in another book that's been published about New Zealand birds. But imagine that, pooping 9 metres in a day. I'm sure children would love a fact like that thrown into a story.
Yeah, that's amazing. And that's exactly the kind of thing that when I was writing these books, it's finding those little Easter eggs that do hook kids in, because I found it hard to get into bigger books. So I love the illustrated books, and to get that hook into a larger book to read, it was those little things, like little facts and funny things that can kind of hook a child into reading. So I think first step for me was falling in love with the drawings, and then I really started to fall in love with the stories.
Yeah, and so an illustrator first and then a storyteller, but you wrote Kui, Kui's First Egg, from a very personal place, didn't you, as a very young mother. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so I had two daughters, so I was just had a new little person in my life, and as you do in that period of your life, it's hard, and you feel like you're kind of doing everything for the first time, especially I had an 8-year gap between my kids. So it was my first daughter, and then when Willow was born, I felt like I was learning it all over again and making mistakes. And so that's really the premise of the first egg story, is she has this egg. She has no idea why she has it, especially normally it's the male kiwi that incubates and cares for the chick. So this female kiwi, for whatever reason, has found herself alone with an egg, and she kind of tries to work out what she's supposed to do with it. And as she's doing it, she's kind of stuffing up every now and then. But in the end, the story of it is that she cares for the egg and it hatches, so she knows what the purpose of it is in the end, and still will make lots of mistakes in the future stories.
Yeah, it really is very touching and very beautifully told, and it's interesting because the kiwi, who is the childlike but maternal figure in the story, learning her way, but at the same time, the real child, the egg, does feel so loved. And so it's this lovely kind of connection between mother and child in learning and discovery, which I think is probably, as well as the beautiful illustrations, why it has stood the test of time as a story. You now have 6 tamariki cat. Am I right?
Yes, I do. So I met my husband 7 years ago now, and he already had 3 beautiful boys. So I had 3 daughters, Jono had 3 sons, and we combined, so like a New Zealand version of the Brady Bunch, I guess.
Yeah, very symmetrical.
Yeah. and it's amazing. Like, we really are lucky that our family have blended so well together, and they are a huge inspiration for me for my stories, because there's just never a dull moment when you've got 6 children.
Yeah. And so how on earth do you find the time to produce any work at all? And talk to us about making space for your creative life.
So I definitely make, I've got a business, and I'm lucky to be writing and illustrating and designing full time. So we have a publishing warehouse and studio, and so I dedicate my work time to writing and illustrating, which a lot of people can't do, and I'm very grateful that that's where I'm at. So it is, I make sure I treat it like a job, and I try to work within the confines of 9 to 5, but it's not a realistic thing for me. So when the kids are in bed, I'm often working and drawing, sometimes before they wake up, and then also when they're with me. So they really love looking over my shoulder and telling me, giving me some feedback, sometimes harsh and very helpful, about what they like and what they don't like about what I'm doing. So, it is very much a work in family environment. So work-life balance is all intermingled a little bit.
Yeah, busy, and just, I suppose, major admiration flowing through the microphone towards you, Kat, from me. It's been a while since I was a working mum, but I only ever had 2. So being a working mum with 6 sounds like a lot, as I'm sure many of our listeners will identify with. This anthology, and I think earlier works and product from your business, from Kiwi, is linked to the Save the Kiwi campaign, isn't it? So, and it's made a very substantial, over the years, you've made a very substantial contribution to that campaign, which is super admirable. You must feel proud of that.
Yeah, it's really cool. It was one of the main drivers for making sure that the series was successful too. So I do always suggest to new authors that they find something that they really are passionate about that they could raise money for, because it does help you to promote your books, because it's not always, we're tall poppies in New Zealand, so you don't want to blow your own trumpet too much. But when you're working for a cause, you do feel like you can push a little bit harder and yeah, so when I first came up with the concept, I had approached a couple of publishers, and they were very keen, but the amount that I wanted to give to Save the Kiwis, which used to be Kiwis for Kiwi, was just a little bit high when you don't earn a whole lot out of book royalties. So the portion just wasn't enough for me to kind of make a living out of it. So I decided to publish it myself and do all of the custom shipping. I have a couple of amazing distributors that I work with, and they do all of that legwork. It's tricky. part is tricky.
It's quite wonderful that and that a choice to kind of give has also been the impetus behind generating your own business, which is self-sustaining. So it's a very, that's a great story, and I'm sure that many writers will find that inspiring. Kuwi and his friends have also worked with Kaituhi Pania Papa to author a Te Reo Picture Dictionary published in 2021, haven't they? As a Kiwi author and illustrator and mother, just can you tell listeners about the way that the place of Te Reo has changed for Aotearoa's young readers and what your thoughts and feelings are about that?
Yeah, so that kind of stems back to my first job when I was 18 and I left school. I got my first job at Te Wānanga Aotearoa in Te Awamutu, and I just was very lucky to fall into the perfect role. So I was an administrator there, but I studied Te Reo Māori, and my kaiako there were Pania Papa and a couple of other tutors. So right from that young age, I'd met Pania, so probably the most amazing kaiako in New Zealand. and from there, she had seen me drawing, because one of the ways that I found it easier to retain language was to draw, like little comic strips. They had had the same kind of concepts for some of their programs, and so I started to illustrate for the Te Ara Reo Māori program. That was way back in, I think, 2000. And, and then when I went on maternity leave with my eldest daughter, I ended up taking that work with me and continuing illustrating for Wānanga and Pania's separate business as well. Our working relationship is long-standing. And we'd also created a Māori Picture Dictionary for adults back in, I think, 2002. And so when I had kind of watched the market to see if anyone was going to bring out anything really New Zealand in a picture dictionary, there's a lot of kind of American and UK ones that had been translated into Māori, approached Tania, and she was very keen to do one. And using the Kuwi and Friends brand as well, so that it relates to children, they can connect with that, but also it is also aimed at adults, because a lot of us adults are still learning or just beginning our journey of learning. So that's kind of how that fell into place. And that, since we released, so I think it was released in 2020, and we have found a few challenges, as you can imagine, with the change of government and kind of a move away from a governmental move away from Te Reo, which is really sad. But in my sales and what I see from people, they are even more interested and more driven to increase their knowledge of Te Reo. So it's pretty cool. Hard times, but also I think it shows that people are really passionate and believe in what they believe in, rather than kind of being driven by what we're being told at the moment.
Kia ora. Yeah. And I think that love for Aotearoa's creatures, the joy of children, and the love of Te Reo, they all come through really strongly in your books. The book is Kuwi, the Kiwi Treasury. It's a perfect Christmas present for new parents or a taonga to enjoy with Pepe and the younger tamariki in your life. It's a gift that will stand the test of time. Published, illustrated and published by Kat herself. And it's available through Illustrated Publishing website, along with a treasury of Te Reo resources. It's also available through WIC Halls and other bookstores while stocks last.
You're listening to Bookends on Plains Media, broadcasting on 96.9 FM, streaming live and available as a podcast on plains.org.nz.
Another magnificent book from Massey University Press to round out a year of magnificent books It is called The Collector. It's about Thomas Cheeseman and the making of the Auckland Museum. And it's written by Andrew Mackay and Richard Wolfe, who are both eminently suitable for writing this. Andrew did his PhD on Thomas Frederick Cheeseman. And Richard, of course, has written, I think, around 40 books on everything, from the Moa to New Zealand art, and worked for a long time at Auckland Museum. Richard, but I'm talking just to Richard, not to push Andrew out of the spotlight, but how was it to write this book together, Richard?
Well, it was a very convenient arrangement because, you know, I joined the staff of the Auckland Museum in 1978, shortly to become curator of display, and very quickly, even though Cheeseman had died in 1923, 50 years earlier, I very quickly became aware of the significance the part he had played in the history of the Auckland Museum. And so all my years there, 19 of them, I think, I tried to interest other staff members in collaborating on a book, but we were all a bit busy and didn't quite get round to it. But after I left, my interest, it didn't wane. I was still keen. I thought this guy certainly deserved something. And then I found out about Andrew doing his doctorate on Cheeseman. I thought, right, this could be the opportunity. And it turned out he was looking for someone to work with. So it was a very happy arrangement. I mean, he had, for his research on Cheeseman, he'd been through all the correspondence and letters, which is something I hadn't done. But then I'd worked in the museum and was pretty familiar with its history and aspects of the growth of the collection and all that sort of thing. So it was a good arrangement. So, you know, as I say, Cheeseman, it's had to wait 102 years for a book on him. So had we not sort of got together, he might have had to wait a bit longer. But no, it was a very convenient arrangement. We got on well and it all just sort of fitted together. And, yeah, it's just so gratifying seeing the finished product, of which Massey University Press done a magnificent job in terms of packaging, you know, putting all our words and pictures into something, you know, it looks very attractive.
There were a number of reasons I was drawn to this book. One is that my great-grandparents arrived in Auckland round about the same time as Thomas Cheeseman did. So all the description of what was going on in Auckland and how things were developing, I kept imagining them being there and you know, how life would have been for them. And also as a child, because I had grandparents in Auckland, we visited, and going to the museum was very much a part of, you know, my memories of being in Auckland, and specifically the collection of Māori objects.
Yes, yes, yes. Well, yes, as you say, I guess about the time your great-grandparents. Well, you know, Auckland was a bit of a ramshackle sort of settlement in the early days, and while there was a mechanics institute for promoting education among young people, there weren't any tertiary institutions or anything like that. And Cheeseman arrived in town and basically was a self-taught botanist. It's sort of said that as he stepped off the boat and walked downtown Auckland, he was immediately impressed by all the botany, you know, the plants, and he was collecting already. He established the museum. Had been going since 1852. It had started off fairly promisingly, but soon sort of fell by the wayside. I guess everyone in Auckland visited it. So it's sort of running out of funds and enthusiasm. But with his appointment in 1874 as both curator of the Auckland Museum and secretary of the Auckland Institute, which is the museum's sort of governing body, it really took off, and there were funds, and there was a new building, and he oversaw the opening of the new building, and subsequently three extensions to that building, and then by the early 1900s, it was apparent that that building, which was on Princess Street, you know, in the city, was growing, running out of space. And in addition to some of the problems, there was a motor garage next door with petroleum stored on site, which was not a good thing to have as a neighbour when you've got large sort of wooden Maori carvings and things. But with the onset of the First World War and all the casualties from the Auckland province, Cheeseman was, I think, one of the first to perceive, you know, come up with the idea of combining a new museum with a war memorial for Auckland. And so he was very much behind it, advocating for this new building. And that's the building we all know, which opened in 1929. But unfortunately, he died in 1923, so he didn't live to see it, but he was very involved with the planning, the arrangement of the galleries. And you mentioned the Maori Gallery. Well, of course, as you go into the Auckland Museum, the Maori Gallery is central. It's the first gallery you walk into, really, as you go through from the main entrance, and it runs the full width of the building. So it really was, it was a great collection which he established, and the Pacific Collection, well, not to mention the Natural History Collections as well. So,
yeah,
the book. He certainly was a collector, but he, on top of that, he was, a museum curator and many other things. A very interesting fellow, and hence, our desire to write a book on him.
Yeah, you talk about him arriving and immediately being attracted by and interested in the botany of the place. And he started corresponding very early on, didn't he? Writing papers about the native orchid, for instance, and corresponding with, people like Charles Darwin.
That's right. Well, he first started off with Joseph Hooker, who was in charge of the Kew Gardens. And, he would... Cheeseman was aware of Darwin, of course, famous for his On the Origin of Species, which was published in 1859. In 1862, he put a book out on the fertilisation of orchids, which was something which perplexed scientists of the day. But Cheeseman, through his collecting and wandering, found a New Zealand specimen, he sort of worked out how it was fertilised by aid of a certain fly, and it seemed that Darwin didn't know this, or it certainly wasn't in his book. So in a rather audacious move, Cheeseman got in touch with Darwin, who, you know, is arguably probably the greatest scientist of the 19th century, perhaps of all time, and wrote him a letter, and he got a positive response back. And there was a certain correspondence between the two. So, Cheeseman was certainly contributing to the wider knowledge of these things. And, as you say, writing to people, not only Hooker and Darwin, but all around the world, sort of bringing the world latest ideas to New Zealand in terms of how museums should be, how collections should be presented, and making them more accessible to the public, all these sorts of things.
That particularly interested me, seeing I've got a curator in the family, was how up-to-date he was, really, with the way people were assembling and displaying things overseas.
Yes.
And so he was trying to keep up with all those things, even though he was, constantly running out of space. Because constantly... acquiring things, it wasn't a fuddy-duddy, dust-filled, collection of rooms. He was really trying, wasn't he?
Absolutely, yes. I mean, those early museums tended to be encyclopedic in their scope. That when they started off, the idea was to collect a specimen of everything, and more than one specimen in a lot of cases. But towards the end of the 19th century, there was this so-called new museum idea, which came in particularly from the United Kingdom, and that required, it sort of advocated that fewer items should be on display and only the best representative examples, and they should all be accompanied by labels. I mean, these are things which we take for granted now, and of course shown to advantage. So this was a big move, and that meant that, probably a large a number of the objects that had been on display were relegated to storage, so you just had the best. So, you know, it's really, as you say, getting away from the dusty, fusty old cases of curiosities and really presenting things to their best advantage.
There was also, I was interested to read, I mean, a growing interest, well, not interest, but a growing sense of concern about how Māori objects and their knowledge was under threat because of the Europeanisation of Māori. And so there was a haste, wasn't there, to acquire things?
Yes. Very early on in the history of the museum, we're aware of comments that, you know, with the arrival of and spread of European settlement, that certain practices among the indigenous people, the Maori people, were dying out, and sort of like implements like digging sticks and canoe paddles, for example, you know, were replaced. Steel was taking over from stone tools. So all the old implements that and ways means of doing things were sort of slowly being replaced, and the museums, not only Auckland Museum, but museums generally saw it as their mission to record these things before they became they disappeared. The other thing too was, of course, all museums were sort of in a sense in competition, and until 1901, with the passage of the Antiquities Act in this country, that there was a great export trade in Maori artefacts and natural history specimens, particularly moa skeletons. Every self-respecting museum in the world really wanted a moa or two. So there was a great trade in these things. I mean, New Zealand museums, particularly Canterbury Museum, which was particularly rich in moa bones, was able to swap, you know, those bones with items from overseas museums. But a stop was put to that in 1901. So in addition to the overseas museums being keen, also the three other museums in the country, the Colonial Museum in Wellington, the Christchurch, Canterbury Museum in Christchurch, and Otago Museum in Dunedin, they're all, you know, adding to their collections and where they could, keen to acquire by one means or another Maori material before it sort of disappeared or deteriorated or whatever. So, you know, some of those acquisitions, looking back, there's a bit of controversy around them in terms of how the process was carried out. But, you know, I think looking on the positive side, that material was preserved, and it is, you know, largely there to be seen and enjoyed by all. So that was really the aim of the museum, to bring the wonders of the natural world and human endeavours and achievements to the populace at large.
I was fascinated. I know that is, as you say, there are a lot of contentious and rightfully so issues around acquiring those things, and they are being aired and have been aired. But I just want to say I was intrigued by because you detail from time to time some of the papers that were given at the Institute, you know, from people, amateur and professional, about what kind of matters were intriguing the intelligentsia they weren't necessarily that, but those who had an interest in natural sciences and and politics even.
You're absolutely right. It was a very wide range of topics. This was another one of Cheeseman's jobs. When he was appointed in 1874, as I mentioned earlier, he became secretary of the Auckland Institute, and that had monthly meetings for members, but open to the public, and lectures were given, and these were subsequently published and made available and reported in the press. And I mean, this was long prior to the establishment of Auckland College, or University College. So this was this is where people came to discuss things, and the topics are so wide ranging. I mean, from aspects of sewerage systems in Auckland to widening of streets to natural history, evolution versus religion. Yes. I mean, all the matters of the day were discussed here, and you know, it must have been a pretty interesting evening to go to listen to some of these. I mean, conservation at that stage, a number of people were already concerned. The 1870s, 80s of the destruction of the native bush, and you know, so a lot of very important matters were aired, and as I said, subsequently published in the Transactions of both the Auckland Institute and also the New Zealand Institute, which was associated with the Colonial Museum in Wellington.
We also need to acknowledge the work that he did as a botanist, because
absolutely, yes.
As well as all his duties at the museum, he continued his interest and on a very high level, because he put together the Manual of New Zealand Flora, which came out in, I think, 1906, didn't it? But it
yes.
was, he constantly, that had come out before in a different form, and I think this was him sort of revising and redoing it.
Yes. Yeah, there had been efforts to produce such a definitive book previously, but the person undertaking that had unfortunately died, so Cheeseman took it on. He did actually get time off work to do this. He was relieved of his duties from being curator and secretary, so that's enabled him. I don't know whether he sat at home and wrote it or what, but yeah, in regard to his collecting, he had a personal herbarium, and there this was in his own home premises in Remuera in Auckland, which he donated, I think, something of 10,000 specimens. You know, it was probably the largest such accumulation by an individual in the country. And, I mean, it's hard to know how he found time to do this, because, I mean, being a director, and the other thing I'd like to point out, he was curator. I mean, it's the same as director, it's just the terminology, but he was in charge for 50 years, which, you know, had a bit of a look, a bit of a Google, and I think it's certainly a New Zealand record, and it wouldn't
phenomenal.
Surprise me. If,
yeah.
Absolutely. Mm. I wouldn't be surprised if it's a world record.
Yes.
For an individual to be in charge of a major museum for 50 years, I think, absolutely astonishing. And it's not that he was retired or made redundant or relieved of his duties. He died, you know.
In the job.
yes. Basically, not in the office, but he was actually at home preparing. There was an institute meeting that evening, and they had to call it off. And you know, in respect to his passing. So yeah,
yes.
78, I think. So I think he probably just wore himself out. So busy, you know, running that place. And
Well, I'm not surprised that you and Andrew were so keen to put this book together. So thank you for all the work you've done. And the way it looks, the way it reads, it's of huge interest to you know, a wide range of people. So thank
sure.
you.
Thank you, Maureen.
The book is called The Collector. It's about Thomas Cheeseman and the making of the Auckland Museum. It's written by Andrew Mackay and Richard Wolfe and published by Massey University Press.
You're listening to Bookends on Plains Media, broadcasting on 96.9 FM, streaming live and available as a podcast on plains.org.nz.
Caring for Kahurangi is, as its subtitle suggests, the inspiring story of Friends of Flora. It is beautifully told by Sandy and Robin Toy, with photos by Rudy Mossaman, three of those eponymous friends. This group's story deserves to be told. They have done so much to restore the rich biodiversity of this very special part of Kahurangi, the rohe surrounding Wharepapa, Mount Arthur. The book includes lively contributions and special guest mentions from many of the wide wide community of volunteers involved over the 25 plus years the project's been running. The book is produced as beautifully as we all know to expect from Potten and Burton, with Rudy's glorious images, plenty of space to absorb all of the rich information. It's full of science as well as heart. I found it inspiring and uplifting, and I challenge any reader not to be moved by the aroha for Aotearoa that soaks every page of this book. I'm joined by Sandy and Rob to discuss the book. Tēnā kōrua, it's wonderful to have you on the show.
Kia ora, Marianne, and thank you for that lovely introduction.
Well, yeah. The story starts with the feel. So I wondered whether either of you two are bird callers and whether we could hear an imitation, and then perhaps whether you could just describe this wonderful little steep water duck and the special landscape they live in.
I think for an imitation, you'd actually need Marianne Avers, who is Friends of Flora's founder.
Okay.
She does a wonderful imitation.
Neither of you are brave enough to give us a try?
No.
Bring it.
Wouldn't do credit to the duck.
Okay, well then perhaps just describe for us this gorgeous little duck and the landscape that we're talking about here.
You're right, Marianne. It really is a gorgeous duck. Its other name is the blue duck, and it's got the most subtle blue-grey dusky plumage with lovely rusty speckling on the breast. And particularly in the Flora's Stream, in the project area, there are a lot of grey rocks and boulders. And often if it's just sitting on the bank, it's just perfectly camouflaged. It disappears completely. And you don't see it until it lifts its head up from where it's roosting. And then you see a beautiful ivory-coloured bill and a bright yellow beady eye. Mm. And then, of course, it'll whistle to say hello, and you know it's there. But the thing about it is it's one of Aotearoa's most threatened ducks, because it's very vulnerable, as all our tonga species are, to predation by stoats. It's a ground nester, and so the females on the nest as well as the ducklings are vulnerable. But it also requires fresh, fast-flowing water, high mountain streams, and those don't occur on offshore islands or in fed sanctuaries. So really the only way to keep our precious veal is to have really good predator control in situ in our mountainous places like Kahawangi National Park.
Yeah, so thank you for that. So it climbs and plays in these steep river gullies, this duck, and feeds on invertebrate. So tell us about its special bill as well.
Yeah, that's incredible. It's got a sort of rubbery membrane around the outside of the bill. So it looks like it's got fat lips. And we don't really know the reason for it, but it may help to protect the bill when it's foraging on the rocks.
Yeah, its distinctive face is very, cool. Very endearing, and there are many beautiful photos in the book. That thing about it, this is an incredibly difficult conservation task for this bird because of these steep gullies, and you just don't find them offshore, and you don't find and you can't really fence areas where this happens. So that means that this is a forever trapping project in Aotearoa, given how widespread stoats are. Do you want to just talk about that, the fact that this is a forever project?
We really, really hope it's not a forever project, that at some stage in the future there will be a solution that enables us to eradicate stoats within Aotearoa. But until then, we are dependent on killing stoats, and that means trapping, but that can only be done on a relatively limited scale. I mean, Friends of Flora has 10,000 hectares of trapping, but that is enormous in that habitat. So it's either trapping or aerial 1080.
Yeah. And
which kills rats and then by secondary poisoning stoats.
Right. And so and they work together, right? There's three maps in your book over the course of the Fio story, which is only part of the Kahurangi story, but it starts with the Fio, and there are those three maps which show the extent of the trapping, the extent of the catch, and then the third map showing that catch dramatically reduced after a 1080 drop. It's quite a remarkable story of conservation. Do you want to talk a little bit more about that?
So Friends of Flora's vision has always been for biodiversity restoration. So trapping is just a means to achieve biodiversity restoration. So that means that we monitor individual species and always have done quite closely. So as Fio expanded from the initial Flora Valley into other streams and other rivers, we expanded the trapping network. And that's why there's phases of trapping development. We're probably close to the limit of what volunteers can do, but I always hesitate to say that. Trapping is certainly effective for much of the time in reducing stoat populations to a level at which Fio ducklings can survive. But when we get a beach mast situation and there is a huge influx of resource, that leads to a rat eruption, and the rat eruption fuels a stoat eruption, and then we really do need the 1080 to knock the rats back and by secondary poisoning the stoats.
Mm. I just found it extraordinary the thinking about the number of volunteer hours and the volunteers pacing up all of that difficult terrain, up all of those trap lines, not just for the trapping and for the clearing the traps, but for the all of the observation. It's huge, this project. Do you have you ever done an estimation of the total number of voluntary hours or the number of kind of over the years, the total number of volunteers that have contributed?
No, this is the short answer.
Over 25 years, no. Last year, there are about 70 volunteers. About half of those contribute regularly. And I think it was 5,500 hours we put in last year.
Wow. Yeah, it's humbling because you know it's such a wonderful story hearing the recovery that is a product of all of those hours of trapping, those stories of recovery are beautifully told. So, tell me where the Fio were at when you started 25 plus years ago, and where they're at now.
Well, it was just
numbers.
Down to a single male Fio left, just one. I mean, they were literally effectively gone when one male isn't much use.
No, we all know that. We all know that, Sandy.
So it's been absolutely massive that just a couple of years ago, one of the top Fio scientists, Jason Malum, did a survey of the area. And they're now across all of the creeks and spreading out into adjoining areas, and there's now at least 60 Fio in our project area. So it's absolutely a wonderful success, and it's now one of the best places around to go and see Fio. And it gets to the stage where we just take them for granted, but it's really. Yeah, we very nearly lost them altogether.
I tramped the Mount Arthur Tablelands in 2008, early 2008, and So, and, you know, which was a wonderful one, super beautiful. And it's really, well, lots of the images really took me back there, but we didn't have any field sightings back then, even though you were a few years into your project. We were hopeful and we read a little bit about the project then. But this has inspired me to want to go back and see all of the biodiversity that is flourishing as a consequence of the project. So perhaps we need to go on and also talk about the great spotted kiwi, because that is another part of the story. And this, the Friends of Flora has just kept evolving, really, hasn't it, in terms of your biodiversity vision. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, Phil was the catalyst for Marianne and Bill setting up the group in the beginning, 25 years ago. And having re-established Phil and the trap network was expanding, then the group started to think about, well, what else would benefit from such a good trapping network? And Roror, Great Spotted Kiwi, is the obvious one. They had been in the area decades before, but had completely disappeared. So, that was the next project. And that was a much, much more ambitious project because it involved translocating kiwi from the wild in areas without predator control at the time into the area. So that was four big expeditions and transfers, followed by 8 years of fortnightly monitoring by a team of incredibly committed volunteers. Yeah.
Astonishing, fortnightly monitoring, and again maps there of the territory that those birds establish, and wonderful scientific information through the book about really the science of conservation, which feels almost, you know, akin to a kind of epidemiology, you know, in terms of the mapping and the information, the data that you need. Yeah, so wonderful science in the book. Thank you. Who do we have to thank for that?
Oh, both of us. We are both ecologists.
Right.
I mean, one of the most gratifying things about the whole Kiwi project is that in 2018, we took transmitters off the birds, so we couldn't follow individual birds. But we do have quite an extensive network of trail cameras out there. Which we use to monitor pests, but it also keeps picking up kiwi in places we didn't know they were. They're birds without any band on, so we know they've been bred in the flora.
Yeah.
It's just enthralling. And visitors tell us how they've heard the kiwi calling, and that is, just very fulfilling.
Indeed. In fact, the book opens in the preface with a story of your find together of the first chick who's bred wild in Kahurangi. I wondered whether one of you might like to read that. But perhaps before we do, because we're not quite at time, we could just go on. So the Roror is the other fabulous story. We've got chapters dedicated to the Fiol, many chapters dedicated to the Roror and the conservation story there. But then we also have this exploration through the final sections of the book of the biodiversity of this region. And I thought it might be worth just saying why. Why is there this incredibly rich biodiversity there, and just talking a little bit about that?
Yeah, that's something that's always really fascinated me. We've had the privilege of spending 15 years getting to know that area really, really well. And everybody knows our national parks are a wonderful scenery and landscape, and Kahurangi is definitely up there. But when you spend the time looking in detail and exploring the areas, you realise there's actually so much more to it, that the diversity is incredible. And having done the two big reintroductions, we had a bit of a hooey and thought, well, what next? And we realised that we didn't actually know what was there, how much special things there were, and what state they were in. So, yeah, the group decided that actually trying to focus on finding out more about what was there and what the problems were was a bigger priority than trying to bring back other species. And so that's led, that's really been the last 10 years or so has been focusing on other species like the Mount Arthur giant wetter, marble clematis. That species occurs only in a couple of mountains in our project area, nowhere else in the world.
Yeah,
it's just extraordinary. And I think that's all down to the sort of diversity of landforms and the geology and the fact that it has had, you know, relatively little human interference.
And I think one of the wonderful things for me is that it's also, we know about it because there's this team of volunteers who have loved it and have documented it, and that perhaps there are other parts of Aotearoa with as rich specific biodiversity to be encountered or loved and recorded. So it really is this book kind of, for me, one of the things about it was that inspiring that conservation passion, a book to be shared with generations, ideally. Are you nervous about the sustainability of the project over time?
We've always been nervous about that because it's not that big a catchment in terms of people for the volunteer base. We've always been nervous and we've always pulled through. So we have to be hopeful.
Mm. Do you have young people engaging with the project and bringing, imparting that passion intergenerationally in families?
So we do have young people sign up, but of course they tend to go off and lead their lives, and some of them come back, and we hope that we inspire them to get involved elsewhere if they are in, if they move away. So, yes, we'd always like more young people, but there are some.
Great.
I really like that you refer to the volunteers' love of the area. A local journalist said about our book that it was a 300-page love letter, and I thought that does actually sum it up. You know, love of the place leads to practical action.
Indeed. Indeed, and perhaps we're going to have to finish with that rather than have time for the reading. Listeners, I fully recommend that if you get as far as reading page to page 9, the first two paragraphs of the preface will have you hooked on just that, aroha for Aotearoa and for our precious birds. So the book is Caring for Kahurangi. I've been speaking with Sandy and Robin Toy, who are the authors, and it's published by Potten and Burton, and a wonderful gift to treasure, book to treasure, and hopefully inspire conversations that inspire action.
And join us, Marianne Stone and Maureen Rout, on Bookends, sponsored by Scorpio Books, next Tuesday on Plains Media.